core ideas that have informed his ministry. And I am happy to share that Stephen is one of the people with the most integrity and joy and compassion that I know. And in one of my early retreats with ministers in Canada, I was in one of his groups for small group sharing, and he was listening to me as a ministerial student. And as I talked, it was his role in this exercise to capture a thought and then to give that back to me. And I still have this little slip of paper he shared with me that day, particularly because in listening carefully, he was able to cut right to the heart of what I was talking about and to offer insight that has still been meaningful as I've carried forward in my ministerial journey. And so today it is with that knowledge that he can listen deeply and then cut to the heart and soul of what's most important that I'm so happy to introduce Stephen Atkinson.
You know, you should lecture more often because you find out things like Carly just said. I had no idea. I remember it, but barely. Before I begin, I want to thank my colleagues for honoring me by choosing me to give this lecture this year. It's unbelievable to think that people who know you want to know more about what you think when you're someone who talks all the time. And also, I'm a practitioner, not an academic, so I don't think of myself as lecturing. But as a preacher, I'm not going to let that stop me today. Now, a couple of days ago, I saw a cartoon. Someone sent it to me, and I don't know if you can paraphrase a cartoon, but that's what I'm going to do. The setting is an old Mayan-style temple, so a big pyramid, big high square steps going up to the top. And at the very top, the whole top is this gaping maw of a fire god lion thing, teeth and flaming mane. And at the bottom is a guy with a man on either of his arms, and they're trying to get him to go up the steps. And he says, "Wait, wait! I'm not a member, I only come on Sundays." So now I know why some of our long-standing visitors are not climbing up the steps into the maw of the beast. Well, none of us here at the CUC can claim we're not members. We're in like a dirty shirt. And some of you may see some of what I have today as something like that gaping maw. But we like to try new things, don't we? Now, a story that I love to tell from time to time comes from writer and author Holly Bridges Elliott, and I found it in Frederick and Mary Brissat's wonderful compendium of readings, thematic, spiritualized readings. The book is called Spiritual Literacy. Holly Elliott is in her kitchen one day at noon. She's had just made lunch for her children, and they're there eating the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and she stops in mid-bustle, as she puts it, and looks around. The entire room became so luminous and so alive with movement that everything seemed suspended, yet pulsating. For an instant, like light waves, intense joy swelled inside me, and my immediate response was gratitude. Gratitude for everything, every tiny thing in that space. The shelter of the room became a warm embrace. Water flowing from the tap seemed a tremendous miracle. And my children became, for a moment, not my progeny or my charges or my tasks, but eternal beings of infinite singularity and complexity, whom I would one day, in an age to come, apprehend in their splendid fullness. Now, if you ask Unitarian Universalists if some of us have had experiences like that, you'll find that we often have. We don't always talk about them. We're not sure how they'll be received. And you might feel surprised at that, as these are moments that challenge our usual sense of reality, and we UUs do tend to be focused very much on what is real. The thing is, such experiences are intensely real. The shimmering of the air is more concrete to Holly Elliott than the kitchen counter. And memories of such moments remain vivid long after. Life is enlivened perhaps merely for seconds, but the impact of them is profound. Often some change or even transformation results, a new attitude, a heightened awareness, a decision to make a turn. Some of you have had these moments. And some of you, I think, are immediately starting to categorize them in a way that helps you contain them. But they're not for containing, nor defining, nor measuring. They're for awakening us. And we all need some kind of awakening, in my opinion. Moments like the one I just told are powerful only for those who have experienced them. Yet we need something to awaken us, and I see UUs as needing that a lot. We do and want to do so much good work in the world that we need all of ourselves to be alive, humming, and present, or we run dry, burn out, or worse, become unaware of our impact on others. And without being aware, we can be harmful despite our intention to live well and to make a positive difference. And that, in a nutshell, is my whole message today. Life offers more value to us than we imagine, and not only for a shimmering moment. We must find our way to wake up to that, and we must be so aware that we avoid harm when we're trying to do good. In fact, this today is an old-fashioned three-point sermon. I just get extra time. First, we'll look at the emerging field of neurotheology that studies what's happening in the brain when spirituality or beliefs are involved. Our brains are the common ground on which we both experience reality and by which we understand it. The brain is our spiritual organ. And then I want to consider our third principle, the acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. There are too often painful barriers against cohesiveness in our communities, based simply on different ways we interpret and speak about our brain's experiences. And finally, let us consider that attending to our spiritual lives individually and together is necessary for us to be wise, committed, and effective in how we address the hurt and unfairness in the world. Now, it's customary to define spirituality at some point, but I resist this precisely because the church I serve, North Shore Unitarian, as you heard, in West Vancouver, today offered its 28th service this year defining spirituality. There's more to come. This long weekend, it was canoeing as spiritual practice. We're considering many answers this year to a big question. What does it mean to live spiritually? And we hope that each of us either discovers or begins to seek a spirituality that emerges from our unique, deeper selves. That won't be the same from one person to the next. Some, never having recognized parts of themselves as spiritual, and yet being able from that recognition to lead us to greater depth, meaning, and purpose individually and as a community. Our mission statement, the short version, is belong with heart, thrive in spirit, act in service. And if we want to offer others a spiritually enriching community to thrive in, we figure we better know what we mean. For instance, by focusing on living spiritually in our relationships and from a position of integrity, we have been attending to our true selves. And that's an idea I'll expand upon later. I've become uninterested in defining spirituality because that tries to contain it in the frontal lobe, the frontal cortex, when it belongs to the whole brain. It belongs to the brain and the endocrine system and the gut and the breath and the unconscious and, well, fill in your favorite organ for what is enlivened in your spirituality. Yes, the frontal cortex needs a grasp of spirituality, but I'm deeply reluctant to allow it to dominate that grasp. To me, spirituality is what most moves you, charms you, lifts you, excites you, even what scares you because it feels too big or seems beyond your grasp. Feel it with your whole body. Conjure up the feelings you have about it. Notice your pulse, your breathing. Listen, look, feel, smell what's just beyond your ordinary perception. And then notice what that makes you think. Your spirituality is in there, in all that. It's cognitive, visceral, and ethereal all at once. Now, what drives me to speak this afternoon is a vision that I'm full of hope about. It's of our being loving and accepting of each other as we are. Every one of us, both a wondrous and gifted being and a mass of contradictions and failures. In this love and acceptance is great patience with each other and a true welcoming of how we are different. I'm also driven by a yearning. Until we achieve the qualities of connectedness I'm presenting, some of us are suffering needlessly. I see many of us too often narrowing our peripheral fields down to one or a couple of favorite principles, and often only one source. That, or we pick and choose those that confirm what we already think or feel, or worse, those that challenge us the least. Inevitably, this leaves out, diminishes, or disregards some within our own communities who see the world differently. I yearn for us to open our minds to the degree that we claim to value. Every dream has its opposing nightmare, so I'm also driven to speak from my fears for us. At the UU Ministers Institute for Excellence last February, in the workshop I took, I was shocked to hear that a church like mine is dying. Not necessarily gasping its last breath, but in the process of dying. We have not adequately sustained ourselves financially for many years, and through both deaths and relocations and a society hotly competing for people's time, we're at risk of losing a sense of upward momentum in terms of enthusiasm and energy. And we will die unless we find a way into renewal or even rebirth. And what is true for North Shore is also true for most, not all, but most Canadian congregations, and I believe for our national community. By not adequately sustaining ourselves financially and by gradually losing the enthusiasm and zest for the work, we too are dying. I know this is hard to hear, but the most important truths are important, so someone must say them. And we have two options, renew or die. I'm proud that North Shore already has plans towards its rebirth as a church that truly is ready to serve current and future generations, but it will be a lot of work. And in the interest of full disclosure, many of you know, but not all of you, that I'm leaving my ministry there this summer, June 30th, my last day. Partly because of their eagerness to recreate themselves for the future, and my virtual total ignorance of how to lead them there. Some other minister, no doubt, has many ideas of what to do, and they will find that person, I do hope. But if our congregations aren't to renew themselves, we must solve some of the problems, chronic institutional problems that cause us to languish. The first of these is our difficulty finding a common theological ground, and I do not mean dogma, but a common, deep, inspiring, and path-setting foundation that we all respect. I think we can agree that one part of that common ground is recognizing that whatever we experience or believe, our truth is in our brains. To begin looking at the part the brain plays in our various spiritualities, join me in a short exercise if you care to. Don't worry, it's all in the head, just like where we like it to be, right? You may want to close your eyes, that's up to you. But as you gather yourself in this moment, think about some physical activity that of yours that's a favorite that you'll think about today, right here in a moment. Think of an activity that to some extent you practice or rehearse, something you want to get better at. It might be a sport, it might be fine chopping vegetables, and for some, it might be as simple as flexing that painful arthritic joint. So take a moment to choose the activity. And now, without moving your body, imagine in your mind every step of that activity. Pick each movement of the action and internally rehearse, sending that motion to your finger or elbow or hips or wherever it should go without moving. Think about each part of the whole movement. And when you've gone through all the parts, let the imaginary motion flow all at once. Practice in your mind the flow of your tennis serve, or thin slice a whole carrot, or move that painful joint. Add in the sounds, sights, and other sensations you usually feel when doing this activity. And now run through it again. Neuroscience teaches that without moving, you have just practiced that activity. To the brain, the thought of doing or feeling something is virtually the same as doing it. So it's not a stretch to say that the neurological experience of a mental event, one that is internal, is the same as if it were real. And this is important when we consider the brain's experience of spiritual events. This is a technical part, not long, but important. Neurological researchers such as Andrew Newberg, the late Eugene DeQuilly, and Richard Anderson study spiritual or mystical experiences as processed by the brain. Newberg and DeQuilly published Why God Won't Go Away, Brain Science and the Biology of Belief, in 2001. It's a fascinating, expansive, technical, and even philosophical work, but very accessible, and I highly recommend it. Newberg, DeQuilly, and Anderson, among others, are best known for performing brain imaging in meditating Buddhists and praying nuns and some other groups and practices as well. Even using different techniques to measure brain activity, the data show that experienced people performing a spiritual practice displayed particular but equivalent patterns from way of thinking to way of thinking, from person to person, from meditating to praying. There are slight differences. In both, the attention center of the frontal cortex is very alive, very active, while an area in the right parietal lobe is less active than usual, and that's an area that orients us in time and space. And although in meditating and even praying, you're definitely wanting to be in the here and now, you're not focusing on here and now. You're focusing on the experience of being present, but not necessarily in space and time. In Praying Nuns, another center of activity is activated, and that's the speech center. And it makes sense because, in fact, praying usually uses language. Not all forms of prayer, but prayer is often language-based. And so prayer has that extra language component in it. So neurologically speaking, apart from the activation of the language center, Franciscans praying and Buddhists meditating are doing the same thing. Their scans are the same. The blood flow is the same. And further, they describe the experience similarly as being in a state of communion with something larger or outside themselves. Identified respectively as God by the nuns and universal consciousness by the Buddhists. Now, Newberg does not dismiss this state of communion as unreal. Rather, he labels them with one term. He calls them states of absolute unitary being, a state of being in union with something. But understand this. He's describing a neurological state that shows up on a scan that is described in words by people afterward. It's in the scans, and it's in the people's minds. And it's a neurological state he calls absolute unitary being. And next, Newberg does something scientifically controversial, and I find it fascinating. I quite love it, in fact. He accepts at face value assertions made by those who meditate and pray skillfully that mystical experience is more real to them than real experience. More real. Most scientists haven't yet got the capacity to deal with subjectivity, or it's dismissed or explained away. But Newberg asserts that neurologically, there's no distinction between objective data such as blood flow and a person's inner experience as they describe it. They're both measured by the scans. They both occur simultaneously. They're all one thing. And so similarly, Newberg accepts participants' claims that absolute unitary being feels more real to them than ordinary reality. It's part of what they describe in common. In comparison, people who have religious or spiritual experiences as part of an abnormal condition, such as epilepsy or mania, usually describes the experience vaguely or confusing, and after the seizure or manic episode is over, they look back and they realize it wasn't real. While in fact, states of absolute unitary being are associated with happiness, stability, and calm increasing over time, and they are felt as being more real than ordinary reality. And so Newberg is adding a layer to what can be seen as scientific, neuroscientific evidence. Subjective experience, while being scanned, is not separate from the hard evidence. It is hard evidence. What is more, skillful meditation and prayer are described as going deeply into the self to find the state of absolute unitary being, in which the sense of self then dissolves. Now, I had to think hard about this, so I want you to get it too. The act of meditating or praying, you go deeply into the self, into this state of absolute unitary being, and then your sense of yourself dissolves, and all that feels more real than conversation with your partner. For thousands of years in virtually every culture, human beings describe such experiences in culturally distinct but descriptively similar terms. And so taking all this into account, Newberg concludes that, this is important, neurology does not contradict that there is a deeper self. A state of pure awareness that sees beyond the limits of subject and object and rests in a universe where all things are one. He's not claiming it proves it, but he's saying it does not contradict that. Now, many of us might balk at this, but it's simply the first source of our living tradition. The direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. And those who find a deep source of understanding of reality in themselves through direct experience of what can't be explained away are called mystics. So mysticism is part of our tradition, and it's grounded in neuroscience. Imagine that. Now here's a story. My story. In the middle of the 1980s, I find myself getting into a rut with certain compulsive behaviors, and I enter for the first time one of several different 12-step groups that I qualify for, and I find a way. There's a phrase in the book. I find a way to a faith that works, and that is, it's practical. It includes sharing honestly in groups and practicing daily prayer, among some other things. And I had faith before that wasn't working for me, but the 12 steps gave me this faith that works. And 10 years later, you'd think I'd be better at it, but I'm in a prolonged personal, emotional, and spiritual rut. No meetings, no prayers, no joy. Then one day at lunch in my office, don't know why, I finally feel it's time to pray. And I look over at my old brass clock that's in the office. I have about 40 minutes until my next patient comes. And I figured that's quite a lot of time for a quick little grumpy prayer. But I'm still grumpy. All I do is shut my eyes and start to think, okay, here I am, and whoosh! I am enveloped by what feels like a moving, warm force, like a shawl around me, moving around my head and shoulders. If I was visual, I would think of it as the northern lights dancing around my head. And I begin to weep. And there is something there. It continues for what I feel like is a long time. And so I'm starting to worry about the time. Maybe my patient is going to walk in. But something occurs to me. I don't know why. I think to ask, is there a reason I should keep going and not worry about the time? Well, that's when the ceiling opens. Not the real ceiling, of course. Not like Prior Walter in Angels in America, where an angel actually comes down and wood and plaster dust falls on his head. That's not my experience. But absolute love and acceptance poured down in a torrent from above me. It all felt like it was coming from there. And somehow certainty appears within me. Just boom. My life is just as it is supposed to have been. I have always been okay. Even my worst choices have been okay. And mercy for me and a sense of delight in me just flows down. And I am given to know that it has always been there. And it will always be there. Can you imagine trying to put an end to something like that? But at some point I say, I've got to get back to work. And so I stop. It actually happens later on for a number of weeks off and on. I stop and it recedes. But what's left behind is a man with a changed soul, an expanded heart, and a renewed commitment to life. Just like that. Now clearly this experience is occurring in my brain. There's nothing going on in my office. I even peeked at one point, just to make sure. But a rich, profound, and even sensual event has occurred to me. It's unfolded inside me. And yet I also feel that my cells are actually energized and vibrating. And what begins then leads me step by step, by thousand steps, not into madness, but to you here, right now, here in this place this afternoon. It started there, and then that day. Now, this is a first source experience, direct and mystical. But another source is important to me too, the fifth one. I don't think the order counts except the sixth one was added later. Humanist teachings counsel us to leave the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Neurotheology, I think, undermines the seeming and yet somewhat widespread sense of contradiction between these two sources, direct experience, reason, and science. Now, the Sufi poet Rumi, many of you will know this, he writes of a field out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing. But I think we can think of that as also just out there beyond the ideas of right and wrong. And I'm suggesting we can meet each other there. Newberg scientifically sets out for us a kind of Rumi's field where mysticism and humanism aren't thought of as right or wrong. And if we meet each other there, I bet what we do together there will be to grow spiritually. As we more deeply accept a comfortable and extensive unity of our values, including the value that what you experience and what someone else does not experience have equal room among us. This is how I read the aim of being spiritually grounded as it's written into the proposed CUC vision statement. Us out there in that field beyond right and wrong, spiritually grounded. And I believe that for too long, those who do not have mystical experience have claimed that it's meaningless and says nothing about reality. And neurotheology is telling us different. So now I move to my second point, the third principle. And every part of my personal and professional experience convinces me that to live a vibrant life, we must continually grow as a person. Growth comes from living consciously, sometimes in therapy or self-help groups or spiritual practice, sometimes by facing and learning from our mistakes. Congregations at their best nourish and make room for personal growth. It's not easy. We're programmed to resist change. The natural goal in the living universe is homeostasis. Living systems work to keep things the same so that the life can be sustained, even when they seem to change dramatically, such as from egg to larva to chrysalis to butterfly. We human beings with our soft animal bodies, as Mary Oliver so beautifully says, we want homeostasis too. Now it's true that some people thrive under change and some actively seek new experience, but most of us don't really welcome change. Many of us stick to routines or attend to only what reinforces what we already believe. Now, some people joke about you use running after every new shiny object, but on the contrary, we're often quite satisfied with who and how we are, both personally and in our communities. In fact, I see a tendency to self-satisfaction, complacency, and even arrogance at the idea that we might need to change. A spiritually devastating effect of this is that we avoid examining, let alone correcting, our thoughts, attitudes, and behaviors. If one of us is called into question, that person might take offense instead of to listen. We allow our communities to offer refuge from what we do not want to deal with when they could be spiritual fitness centers. Exercise that practice. Grow that quality. They could still offer us the sense of belonging we seek while challenging ourselves to keep moving forward towards more acceptance, compassion, and appreciation of difference. Unitarian Universalists are good at supporting each other through difficult times, sharing our ups and downs. But I fear that we think more about sustaining who we are than transforming who we are. For example, some of us feel affirmed by principles that support where we stand, while ignoring others that suggest we need to adjust ourselves or open our mind. We can miss the point that the principles are vision statements, shining forth what we hope to become individually and communally. None of us are there yet. The late Reverend Gordon McKeeman observes, "Too many of our members finding religious freedom in our tradition believe that this is the end of the line, that having religious freedom is the end point, and it's not. It's the beginning point. It's what we do with this freedom that matters." Now, on the one hand, this freedom can free us from aspects of culture and tradition that bind and limit us. That's good. Or inspire us to work for the freedom of others, which I'll come to shortly, and that's good too. But too often, we allow this freedom to excuse ourselves from responsibility to improve who we are. Yet historically, that idea is a foundation of our theology, improving who we are. I refer to salvation by character. One of the first distinctions between Unitarianism and Christianity, made by William Ellery Channing about 200 years ago, salvation by character. Today, I see too often, including in myself, that some of us need salvation from character. Ultimately, the transformation of character is our vision of salvation in this life, our need to be saved from ourselves. And I mean the rooted, reluctant, resistant part of us that we can sum up in the phrase false self, a concept taught in both Buddhism and psychoanalysis. But I've been uplifted recently by coming across the works of Father Richard Rohr, particularly. He has a little daily message he sends out. They're wonderful if you can translate them, and some of us can do that. A Franciscan, Father Richard Rohr is a Franciscan who teaches about human experience and spiritual growth in both Catholic and modern psychological terms. And Unitarian Universalists can use the wisdom and guidance he offers. I sure have been. Rohr interprets, for example, Paul's term, sins of the flesh. And ooh, don't I hate that one. Sins of the flesh as having nothing to do with the body, but rather with false self. The masks we wear, the image of how we want to perceive, our illusions of who we are. False self springs more from superficial thinking and social norms and fear than from deeper thought and emotion. It loves to compete and compare, as well as to judge who and what is right or wrong. Often, without open-mindedly engaging in new ideas. False self talks and talks and talks and rarely listens deeply. Modern society, think of politics, athletics, and entertainment in particular, promotes false self behaviors. And few of us, again, certainly not I, can completely silence that voice in us, those responses. Spiritual growth allows for the emergence of true self, assisted by exercising our capacity for honest self-reflection. Blame and shame are barriers the false self throws up to stop us. True self empathizes, not compares. It finds mutual agreement through shared values and goals. True self listens carefully, past the words, to shared feelings. It's more thoughtful about how and when and what to speak. True self faces one's own and others' pain and grief directly and sensitively, eventually coming to see that much of what is most valuable in life is a result of tragic experience. Our desire becomes to root our strength for helping others in our own pain. And I'm glad that, in fact, we hear increasingly often in our culture about concepts like true self because they're around more and more. Our proposed CUC vision statement also refers to our being theologically alive. And in my mind, it means that we live from and in our true selves, the theology of true self. Only by practicing that together can we build the beloved community of which we speak. Only from true self, I submit, can we then consider and engage in truly effective work for the improvement of the world. And this brings me to my third point, that attending to our spiritual lives individually and together is necessary for us to be wise, committed, and effective in how we address the hurt and unfairness in the world. I begin with a story from the life of James Luther Adams, the most prominent Unitarian theologian of the 20th century. Just before starting as theology professor at Meadville Lombard Theology School in 1935, Adams visits Germany to meet with liberal Christian theologians there. Liberal Christianity was actually, it arose in Germany about 100 years before that time. And what Adams finds is that the largest part of the liberal Protestant church is colluding with the Nazi Party policies and actions. There are only a small number of confessing churches, with Dietrich Bonhoeffer as their prominent leader, and it's a social religious resistance. And eventually, of course, Bonhoeffer is executed. Thinking about this later, Adams asks himself, what is it in my preaching and my political action that would stop this? Meaning something as dominant as Nazism. And he concludes that to be involved with other people so that it costs, and so that one exposes the evils of society, requires something like conversion, a sense that there's something wrong and I must be different from the way I have been. Note that I must be different from the way I have been. Not so much a religious conversion as a behavioral one, or an ethical one. Adams uses another theologically and viscerally unsettling term that we tend to avoid, the evils of society. But let us not be timid in realizing that there is such a thing as human evil. He encounters Nazism, after all, and goes on to develop Unitarian meanings for traditional concepts like guilt, sacrifice, discipline, conflict, and tragedy, words that were not so common in the liberal Christian Unitarian theology of his era. And remember, that's the same time when humanism was growing large and prominent in our church. The Reverend George Kimmich Beach observes that Adams' liberalism must no longer be confused with lax, uncritical, or mere broad-minded attitudes, but with nothing less than radical personal change. Now, many of us, I know, many in my own congregation, believe that congregational renewal and vitality can arise solely from having a common external purpose, focused on something greater than our personal interests, namely a rejuvenated and bold program of social action. Now my smart aleck question is, how's that working for us? At the one and only meeting each year when we gather to consider the state of Canadian Unitarianism, we spend a significant portion of our time deliberating, considering detailed social justice resolutions that, in my mind, are ineffective. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about the good people who write the resolutions or even the fact that the resolutions are good. I'm talking about our model of approaching social justice, I think, is ineffective. And I know many will not just disagree with me, but even be angry to hear this. So I simply to encourage you to look back at resolutions made over the last several years to measure their impact in the real world. What part of it can we take ownership of? It's a hard truth to hear. But where in our process does the possibility of personal cost, that as individuals and congregations, we must be different from who and what we are in order to work for that change? Just when do we discuss that? If we want to take flight as Canadian Unitarians and the Canadian Unitarian Council, we need two wings, not just one. And certainly one is public social action, I'm not denying that. But the other has to be greater depth, meaning, and purpose, individually and collectively, and I don't see that coming from anywhere but a spiritual renewal. And without that, I fear we're left to mundane decisions about this policy or that one. In order to deal with the true darkness of our current times, we must know and better master the darkness in ourselves. In our times, we face the rising tyrannies of all the fundamentalisms, not only the religious ones. For instance, we fight an economic fundamentalism that promotes mindless human dominance over nature, but may bring about the inevitable consequence, nature's imminent victory over us. We must also know and better master the darkness that can arise within our communities. We are not free of our own fundamentalisms, among them being the assumption that all of us should think the same way about every social issue, and that not to do so renders other Unitarians stupid or contemptible. Holding on to these attitudes leads to recurrent conflicts that sap and divide us, when what we need and what the world needs from us is a greater unity of effort and spirit. A profound critic of Unitarian Universalism, the Reverend Dr. Davidson Lohr, one of ours, by the way, he's not an outside critic, he offers an even more powerful challenge. He believes that we need to become more religious. I disagree with him about many things, but I love that he says that. In particular, he says he sees a need for us to have a salvation story. Of course, not a supernatural one. Davidson Lohr is one of our most prominent atheists. Rather, he wishes that we could create a this world's salvation story that would describe a more profound understanding of the human condition and its malaise, its suffering, and a story that could offer a sense of how and why living out of the story makes our lives more fulfilling and useful to the larger world. He asks questions like, what's worth believing? Are there profound truths about life that make demands on people whether we like it or not? And further, Lohr lays down this gauntlet. We still have the freedom to choose honest and profound religious paths. The freedom to adopt a moral code so demanding that it insists we always choose the more difficult right thing to do. Instead of expressing religious freedom individualistically, we would do better to allow personal freedom to be impelled by common goals, drawn outside our own circle of interest towards the higher yearnings of society. Einstein is reported to have said, no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. To become the force for growth and progress that we collectively yearn to be, our individual and collective consciousness must be elevated above our common understandings, views, and practices. And when I say common, I don't mean the sense of affinity that holds us together. I mean the most generalized and watered-down beliefs and language that offends the fewest of us, what I call the lowest common denomination. Who are we to step out into the world to say we have these principles to help solve enormous problems when we struggle with our level of consciousness, creating difficulties amongst ourselves? Who do we think we are? Earlier, I described part of my vision for us that drives me to speak today, but there's more. Not just in ourselves, but in our congregations, we will change our level of consciousness so that spiritual qualities such as patience and acceptance manifest in our disinterest in being right, in favor of being more connected. We celebrate that there are 7 principles and 6 sources, and given that many of us hold up one more than one of each, it's beyond me to know the math to configure how many possible configurations that could be, how many different kinds of individual Unitarianisms there are. But we need to be, individual Unitarianisms there are that sustain us and help us to sustain others, that inspire us and are able to inspire others, that are grounded and ready to lift up others, and each one of them has a place. And further, building upon patience and acceptance, we can truly join our forces, our minds, our hearts, our hands, our spirits, towards honest, authentic, and powerful acts of service in the world around us. The successful progress we hope to create depends on our getting our relationships right. Now, clearly, I am not the one to lay out this path towards a future social action. That's not my calling. I'm simply suggesting that we do our internal homework, internal homework, so we know what our motivations are. And that we do this also in our groups and communities so that we can live in relationship with each other. Until we get our attitudes, feelings, and communications congruent and in harmony with our motives. My dream is that each of us accepts the call to identify our baser self-interests so that we might transform them. When we do this, and we are accompanied in life by others doing so, we help to create life and light and wholeness. And this is what our vision statement, our CUC vision statement, will mean in saying we are spiritually grounded and theologically alive. And this form of transformation is what we require of each other. And this transformation is what the world requires of us. Questions or whether that's not part of what we do in the conference lecture. Yes, if I can hear your question, I'll repeat it for the mic if you have any questions or comments or fruit to throw or yes.
You may be willing to answer this because sadly you are leaving us, but I would love to get your idea if it were you and you directed CDC, how would you like to see us go forward? We've also gone through the resolution process in the past one. What do you think would work?
Oh, I begged that question, didn't I? The question is, what do I think if I was in leadership? What do I think might work? First of all, I want to be clear, I'm not leaving Unitarian ministry. I'm just leaving the parish of North Shore Unitarian. I'm actually moving into chaplaincy training in Hamilton in September. And I may or may not return to parish, but I'm thinking of chaplaincy for the rest of my career. It's such a good question. It's such a big question. What next shall we do? Isn't that Marx's question? I think that we could develop a national study program that's aimed at unifying congregations and coming up with, dare I say, congregational theological statements that aren't watered down, lowest common denominator stuff, but have some richness to them, based perhaps on this potential union of scientific evidence and human subjective experience, so that we're actually programming some kind of unity and growth and spiritual growth into our congregational practices. I think that's one thing. And then, on the other side, I wonder if it might not work if we actually took some way of measuring where does the national community stand on taking a common position on a social issue and really making that the Canadian Unitarian issue. I realize there's so many beautiful competitions for attention. It would be very hard to decide on one. But I'm concerned that if we keep having three or four a year, that often congregations don't do very much about it. At least that's, I'm speaking honestly about North Shore, and maybe that's my failure. I wonder if we might energize people more to know that we're all working with some kind of common purpose. That's off the top of my head. Yes. To sort of remember vaguely what I said, which is actually doing a really good job. I often forget what I've said. I did say that for us, spiritual growth is primarily in this world. I mean, some of us have interests or connections with something that's not explicable, but for all of us, there's an absolute necessity for us to be grounded in this world. And so that means, I think, primarily in our relationships. Buddhism says right relationship. I think we need to do the same thing. And that is going to be harder work than it sounds, because there's so many places in which individually and even congregation to congregation, we're not in right relationship with each other. And so what I said was that we need to be so much more concerned with being connected than we are with being right.
I love that. Yeah.
You know, the old I know there's people here still who love the old debate days, and they were very rich and they were good for their time. But there's so much painful and damaging debate about such crucial and obvious matters in society. I don't think we need debate. I think we need to be connected with each other.
A question.
I see one over here and maybe one there. You, madam? Or sir? I can't. Oh yes, madam, I'm sorry. The light is bad.
I see a very big
conundrum for groups where we're beginning to get some new people involved, we're beginning to feel that our emphasis is to talk to the people out there. Because what you've just spoken about is what Unitarians who've been in it for a while can relate to and resonate to, and all of these issues are so deep in the history. But when we're just trying to bring some people in the door and just trying to have a message that will at least not drive them away, it's very difficult to know where to aim, what you're really talking about, and what's the resonance that you want. And we're very divided, I know, in our group, and we're a small group about more religious, less religious, more spirituality, and it's really something that challenges you to come together about.
Oh, trust me, I know that deeply. And I love my congregation. I love my congregation. I will be so sad to leave. But we have also had struggles around that, some of which and I haven't won all of them. I'm not sure I've won any of them. But certainly I put the conversation on the table much more, and I hope that's a good thing for them. And so again, the question was, sorry, what do we do in creating some kind of common message and the kind of thing that I'm talking about when we're also trying to appeal to newcomers coming in who don't know our history, they don't know anything about our social justice resolutions, or they don't know anything about, you know, salvation by character. And I think the only way you can do it is that you have public services and groups and education classes that are related to our core message, where we really agree. And then we have some of the other discussions, you know, not on Sunday morning, not even after church on Sunday morning, but some other time where the people who understand more and want to be there can come. But again, these answers are off the top of my head. I'm well known as having bad ideas first. And there was a question.
In reference to your mentioning your experience in your office that sounded sort of metaphysical and was a very transformative experience for you, do you think it's possible for that, so looking at neurotheology, for an experience like that to occur in the community level, in the community of our fellowship, and how would that look in what we do?
So the question was whether it might be possible somehow to have a communal or congregational experience kind of like the one that I had in my office. And I would say no, but, pardon me? The answer is yes.
And
you've con, okay. One of these CUC meetings, we should have all the programming led by youth and young men. We have some learning to do. So apart from that, I would say no, but, and the but is, I have been in worship services, some at my own church, but not necessarily from things I've done. We have a fabulous music program and very creative other people working on services, where certainly you know everybody is in the same moment with every hair on their neck standing up. You just know that. And the problem for a minister is that somebody says, "Now, do that again next week." And you can do your best, and sometimes you don't have it, and sometimes it happens despite something that you've done. But yes, there are those, and I think most of us aim for that pretty much every week, but it's a rare moment that we can achieve. I don't know what the time is. 5 o'clock. So, well, actually, thank you so much, both for the engagement afterwards, the questions, for your warm appreciation, and again, for giving me a literal pulpit to speak from. Thank you.
I wanted to just thank Reverend Stephen one last time for his thoughts, and hoping, as in past years, that there may be some fruitful conversation that flows and ideas. If people want to get together at some point to talk, we're going to announce at dinner when you can do that. And where. And so may we go forth honoring what we've heard, allowing it to churn within ourselves and one another, as we create our beloved community and honor the spirituality, the spiritual depth and renewal that may be birthed.